This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Democratic leaders in the U.S. Senate are strongly considering a plan to eliminate the filibuster, a longstanding procedure in the Senate that allows a minority of senators to block debate over controversial bills. And what the filibuster really means is that it takes basically 60 senators to pass a bill in the Senate instead of a simple majority of 50 senators. And history shows us that reaching 60 votes in a highly divided Senate is not an easy task. When many people think of a filibuster, several images might come to mind. One might be efforts by a group of Southern senators to block the passage of civil rights legislation in the 1950s and the 1960s. Another might be actor Jimmy Stewart, an idealistic politician standing on the Senate floor in the 1939 movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington after he's been speaking on the floor for many hours.
Get up there with that lady that's up on top of this Capitol dome, that lady that stands for liberty. Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something. And you won't just see scenery. You'll see the whole parade of what man's carved out for himself after centuries of fighting. There's no place out there for graft or greed or lies or compromise with human liberties.
Does the filibuster serve an important function, or is it an outdated process that allows a minority of senators to unfairly control the will of the majority? Well, that's one of the questions we have for our panel today. Joining us today to talk about this subject, we have Linda Fowler, who is a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College. Linda, great to have you on the program.
Well, I'll try not to filibuster your broadcast.
And also with us, Matt Dickinson, who is a political science professor at Middlebury College. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Bob. I'm invoking cloture right now.
Linda, let's start off with the idea of where the filibuster came from. Sometimes in our history, it's been 60 votes. Sometimes it's been 67. Sometimes it's been 50. Help us understand the historical context of the filibuster. How did it come about?
Well, it came about inadvertently, and the first thing I'd like to do is to make sure your readers, your listeners understand that there's nothing in the Constitution that supports the filibuster one way or the other, and quite a lot of discussion that suggests that the framers would be pretty horrified with the way it's being used right now. The Senate has the power to set its own rules, as does the House. And that's pretty much all the Constitution says about the rules of debate and voting. And very early on in the game, the House, because it grew bigger as the country grew bigger, began to enact measures that made it easier to control the floor. And nowadays, the majority is pretty adept at passing its bills and shutting down the minority. Too much so, I think some people might say. But the Senate managed to avoid imposing a lot of discipline, and that was part of its charm, you might say. But an inadvertent or unintentional decision made a long time ago, Matt, you might want to weigh in here.
Yeah, very quickly, it was basically the filibuster arose inadvertently out of an internal housekeeping decision that was prompted actually by Vice President Aaron Burr in 1806. He said, the Senate is kind of messy. The House is cleaning up its procedures. You have this procedure called move the question that basically says, let's end debate. If a majority of the Senate wants to do it, nobody's using that procedure. Let's get rid of it off the books. And so they did. But that wasn't done deliberately to produce the filibuster. It just was an inadvertent byproduct. The minority began to realize, hey, if we can't shut off debate, then let's just talk our opponents to death, and we'll block anything that we don't like. And that was the origin of the filibuster. Although, as Linda will tell you, it took a while for that really to become a dominant procedure.
Right. And so for a long time, there was unlimited debate. And by 1917, President Wilson was getting very frustrated because his agenda was stalling and his opponents were blocking decision-making about World War One, and so the Senate had enough votes to impose some constraints on the filibuster, but they didn't ban it. What they basically said was people could talk for as long as they wanted until 66 or two-thirds of the members present were voted to cut off debate. And that was the way things stood until the mid-1970s, when again, because of very polarized parties, you began to have the minority abusing the filibuster. And so some other changes were made in 1975. The most important were that it would take only 60 votes or three-fifths majority of the Senate to close down debate. But the one that I think has led to the worst kind of abuse is the fact that somewhere along the way, members were allowed to just say they intended to engage in unlimited debate. They didn't actually have to do it. And so the Jimmy Stewart image of him passing out on the floor of the Senate from exhaustion, or the senators during the civil rights debate sleeping in the chamber, none of that is necessary now. People just, and it's anonymous as well. You don't really know who's doing the filibuster. What all that means is that there's nothing sacred in the Constitution about the filibuster, that pressure to change it often comes from the White House when the president is frustrated over the role of the Senate in stalling his agenda. And it's become particularly acute because the filibuster has become routine rather than the rarely used procedure that safeguards fundamental issues and rights for people who have minority opinions in the chamber. It's become more critical, I think, because the mismatch of population and votes in the Senate has become so acute. And maybe Matt could explain that.
Yeah, very quickly, Linda makes an important point here. The Senate is malapportioned in that the population of the state does not matter when it comes to determining how many senators you have. Every state, whether it's the 700,000 people in Vermont or the 31 million in California, have two senators. And the current configuration of partisan distribution is such that Republicans are overrepresented in that small population states. And so a very small, representationally speaking, subset of senators is able to block a majority will through this filibuster. And because of the malapportionment, it has taken on greater significance if you believe in majority rule.
I think now that about 14% of the population can block legislation, even if the remaining 86% supports it, because of because one Vermonter is now worth 400 Californians. Effectively. Now, I'm sure Vermonters might like that, but it's actually not very fair.
Well, where do Vermont's two senators stand on this issue? Recently, I had a chance to ask both of them this question, and they both said they would vote to do away with the filibuster. Senator Patrick Leahy says he supports eliminating the filibuster because this procedure makes it possible for a minority of senators to block legislation that might be favored by a strong majority of Americans.
I don't believe that if you get elected to the Senate, you come here to vote maybe. You come to vote yes or no. And they should have the courage to vote on these issues. We shouldn't even have to have the question of filibuster. If they're opposed to something, then vote against it.
Senator Bernie Sanders agrees and says the issues at stake, like a new voting rights bill, are too important for the future of the country, so
yes,
he supports efforts to eliminate the filibuster.
And the perfect example, and I can't think of a better example, is that right now, all over this country, what you are seeing is Republican legislatures and governors literally working overtime and with surgical precision to deny African Americans, to deny young people, to deny people with disabilities the right to vote.
Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Patrick Leahy talking to us about their reasons for supporting efforts to eliminate the filibuster. Matt, Linda was telling us earlier that, you know, in the old days, the filibuster, you actually had to be on the Senate floor. And that's the Jimmy Stewart image, and certainly of when the Southern senators decided to filibuster the civil rights legislation, there were pictures of cots on the Senate floor. And then that was changed. How did that change impact the working of the Senate?
Well, it was the working of the Senate that changed the method by which the filibuster was enacted. As Linda said, increasingly the lawmaking procedure incorporates a step in which the threat of a filibuster is enough to force the Senate to invoke cloture, that is, get the 60 votes in order. We're not debating the bill at this point. It's just to proceed. So this past week, for instance, the civil rights bill that you just heard Bernie Sanders talk about was blocked by the threat of a filibuster. And it wasn't filibustering a debate over the bill. It was a procedure to move forward towards that debate. And so what has happened is the Senate, as the House, has increasingly adopted a Tuesday through Thursday work schedule. And they fly out of D.C. to go back and visit their constituents, and we can debate whether that's good or not. They just don't see why they ought to be held hostage by allowing somebody to take the stage and carry out this Mr. Smith goes to Washington in person filibuster. It's not efficient use of their time. And so they are willing to sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Okay, you threaten the filibuster. We'll preempt that threat by immediately moving to a cloture vote. If we can't get 60 votes, it's done. It's a very efficient response to this obstructionist method.
Let's go to our callers and talk to Michael, who is calling from South Burlington. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. My question is another way to think about eliminating the filibuster is how about we eliminate the two-party system and everybody's independent, and maybe people focus on topics and issues instead of having one.
Well, Michael, I think we got the gist of what you were saying. Linda, the two-party system seems to be pretty ingrained in U.S. politics. We can look north at Canada where there's a multi-party system, but the two-party system seems to be with us to stay. Would you agree?
Well, on a lot of reasons, and maybe the most important one is that although the framers didn't provide for a party system in our constitutional system, they immediately formed into parties. And the reason is that it's very difficult, even in a small body like the Senate, for everybody to understand what the bills are about, what's going on, and to organize discussion. I illustrate that in my class on the Senate, on the Congress, every year with a simulation where the students, you know, are sort of blasé about parties. And then they realize once they try to draft a bill that they need some leadership in order to help them figure out what they want to do. And that's why we have parties in the legislature. And the one your caller is proposing would be even more ineffectual than the one we already have.
Let's talk to Alan in Craftsbury. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say, I don't know.
Alan, are you still there? Hey, Alan. Well, we'll try to get back to Alan as soon as we can. Linda, the idea of doing away with the filibuster, if we looked at the actions of the U.S. Senate in the last, 8 or 10 years, we would see a chipping away, or I would say maybe some exemptions to the idea of having 60 votes. And that was done. Harry Reid did it when he was the Democratic Senate Majority Leader. And we also saw it done by the Republicans to exempt judicial appointments to the Supreme Court. Do you think the Democrats are playing with fire a little bit here? Because whatever they put into place to help get through the Biden agenda, it might come back to haunt them in the years later?
Well, let's just make sure. Harry Reid modified the filibuster rules for lower court judicial appointments and executive branch nominees, and he did that because the Senate, basically led by Republicans, was refusing to allow anybody to be even be discussed. And at the time that Reid sponsored the change in rules, to people said there were going to be bad repercussions. And sure enough, when Mitch McConnell, a Republican, took over as majority leader of the Senate, one of the things they did was to say, okay, the Democrats relaxed the rules on the filibuster for judicial, lower court judicial nominations. We're going to do it for the Supreme Court. And that was how they basically got in Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Before that, all Supreme Court nominees were typically being approved by substantial majorities. And Brett Kavanaugh had a very small rate of approval, which is a problem. I think we have the worst possible system now, that we require extraordinary majorities for policy, and we hand out lifetime appointments with a simple majority. But we don't have to abolish the filibuster. My view is we could basically go back to requiring people who want a filibuster to have them actually do it. So there would be some cost to them. Another thing is you could do carve-outs. When the new budget procedures were imposed in 1973, budget bills for budget reconciliation bills were exempted. So those have not been filibustered since the 1970s. And you could also reduce the number of votes. Remember, it went from 66 to 60. Now it could go to 55, say. So you could carve out exceptions for fundamental democratic principles like voting rights, or you could do, you know, there are a number of things that you could do short of outright abolition.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Ron, who's calling from Manchester. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind today, Ron?
My position with the filibuster question is that all of the representatives should be present during the filibuster. I think in that way, action will be quicker.
That's exactly what Linda thinks. Ron, do you think it'll make that much of a difference if you force senators to sleep on the Senate floor? Will they still engage in this activity, or might it make them think twice?
I think if they think about sleeping on the floor, they're going to take some action.
Linda, what do you think?
Mr. Smith style. We've seen two Mr. Smith style filibusters. One was by Senator Hall, who talked for about 13 hours, and another was by. These were grandstanding activities. They didn't change for about 10 or 11 hours. They stopped. And the members weren't present, I don't think, for that. And so they stopped when they got tired. But your listener's suggestion is that they might have been stopped more quickly had they, because they really weren't saying anything. One of them was reading from Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John in Swanton. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks a lot for taking my call. Yeah, I'll just say I can't stand the filibuster. It just sounds like such a silly, ridiculous thing to me, really. But regardless of that, I want to get your thoughts on what are the chances that these group of politicians, or probably any group of politicians, Democrats or Republicans, can think about this and decide whether they like it or don't like it based on whether it's actually a good thing to have, or is it going to be completely whether based on, you know, what's coming around the corner for them? And I'll take your answer offline.
Okay, John, thanks very much. Matt, what do you think? I mean, it seems like the Senate these days, or maybe Congress these days, has a pretty short attention span. What about John's thoughts?
So a couple of your callers have referenced the importance of party. And, of course, the filibuster is a tool of the minority party. And it's a tool that, because the parties have been so evenly matched, and much of what the Senate does now is posturing, as does the House, for the next election in the hope of gaining a poll for a majority, there's a lot less deliberation going on and a lot more sort of symbolic action, and the filibuster is important, a tool. So when we think about filibuster reform in the Senate, you really have to focus that the underlying cause of the increased use of cloture as a way of preventing filibuster, and that's the polarization of the two parties. We have two parties that have become increasingly homogenous. We have liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans, and that wasn't always the case 30 years ago, as Linda well knows. As those parties have become more uniform, they have less interest in deliberating in a way to produce a consensus, because they're so evenly matched and they're fighting for electoral advantage, and they're much more interested in using these procedures to gain the upper hand, to have your team win, or at least appear to win against the other team. So a big part of filibuster reform is changing the underlying dynamics that make each side view the filibuster as a useful tool when they're in the minority. And the question, of course, is, as you point out, if we eliminate the filibuster, how's that going to hurt my party when we're in the minority down the road? I may not want to take that risk. And that's also the problem with carve-outs. Linda mentioned modifying it. Every time you modify the filibuster rule to make it easier to avoid, you set a precedent so that the next time you're in the minority, the other side can say, well, let's have another carve-out.
Interesting point there, Matt. You know, I had a chance when I talked to Senator Sanders and Senator Leahy about this subject, whether or not the Democrats were taking a risk. And Senator Sanders told me, yes, the answer is definitely yes, they are taking a risk. But Senator Sanders said the issues facing the country today are so important that it's worth taking this risk.
Given the reality of what we face right now, the Republican Party becoming a very strong anti-Democratic party, where many of the leaders continue to uphold the myth that Trump actually won the election. If your question is, do I fear that what goes around comes around? I do. But in this moment, majority has got to rule. The American people want to protect the right of all people to vote.
Senator Patrick Leahy told me, yet there are definitely risks for the Democrats in doing away with the filibuster, and he acknowledges that some key Democratic priorities of former President Obama might have been repealed when the Republicans control the Senate.
The Affordable Care Act, which is very popular throughout the country, they could have repealed it if we hadn't had the filibuster when they were in charge. Certainly, a woman's right to choose, they would have repealed that had we not had the filibuster. So it's a double-edged sword.
And I should reiterate that despite those risks, both Senator Sanders and Senator Leahy said they would support eliminating the filibuster because of the importance of the issues that are facing the country. Let's try Alan in Craftsbury again. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for giving me another try after the infrastructure let me down. I was just going to say, I don't know whether they ought to repeal it or not, but if they're going to repeal it, they should do it right away and then push through all of the important pro-democracy, pro-working person legislation that the Republicans have been holding back all these years, and let the voters see that before the next congressional election.
And Alan, is it your hope that if the Democrats were able to pass these bills, that voters would look favorably and give the Democrats a majority in the Senate in 2022?
I think it both goes without saying, and I think it's their only hope of getting a firmer hold on both houses.
And you think the risk is worth it?
I think it might be the last chance we've got as a democracy.
Alan, thanks very much for your phone call. Linda Fowler, Alan brings up an interesting point that the Democrats right now have a limited amount of time. They're talking about big infrastructure projects. They're talking about money for paid family leave. They've got a whole agenda out there that they refer to as their human infrastructure. What do you think of their opportunity to put the foot to the floor and get these priorities passed now and show the country the kinds of priorities you can expect from the Democrats?
Well, there's a lot of appeal in that view. The question is that if it doesn't work and the Republicans do recapture the House and the Senate, all of that hard work will be undone. And at least for 2 years, Joe Biden would probably veto it. But after that, who knows? So I'm very ambivalent about it. I guess before I abolished it, I think what I would do would be to do some more carve-outs the way we've done with judicial nominations and budgets. And I think that fundamental democratic values and having to do with basic rights would be one area that would be that I would be willing to see carved out. I also think that there are some procedural remedies that would just make it a lot more costly for people. Right now, people are kind of cavalier about the filibuster. It really should be reserved for extraordinary situations. But it would also mean we'd have more performance a la Ted Cruz going on, too, which the members actually might enjoy that. I don't, but the rest of us might not. So I guess, given the possibility for unintended consequences, which are always very high in American politics, I'd prefer some incremental changes to the filibuster rule personally. But I will say the more that that a party uses the filibuster to stymie even debate, let alone voting, on popular measures like voting rights, the more the pressure builds to vest more power in the presidency. And in the end, if Congress could figure out how to fix this, it's just setting itself up. And a classic example was the DACA program, where Obama wanted legislation to reform the immigration system. There was a bipartisan coalition to support it, but they didn't have 60 votes, and so it failed. And so you had the president turning to executive orders. And that's no way to govern our democracy.
Matt Dickinson, what are your thoughts about this? We heard from Senator Leahy early in the program who said people get elected to the Senate and they should vote, and that he feels that the Republicans, by invoking the filibuster, are protecting themselves from not voting against popular pieces of legislation. Should the Democrats go ahead and sort of roll the dice here and see what they can pass in the next year and a half?
Well, the decision on whether to reform, carve out, or eliminate the filibuster is always a mixture of principle and pragmatism. Even the original decision to set up a cloture vote, as Linda talked about, the two-thirds vote in 1917, was driven by the Democrats and Woodrow Wilson's desire to get a bill through Congress to arm merchant ships in World War One, and they could have very simply said, we're going to reinstate a majority vote. When the majority wants to block debate, end debate and force a vote, they can do that. But they didn't. They compromised at two-thirds. And that is a reminder that, you know, your decision in any particular context, whether I'm Leahy or I'm Sanders, as these quotes show, is what's it going to do for us immediately, and what are the risks long-term? We need to balance that off. And I would remind our listeners that part of the issue for the Democrats right now is they can't even get 50 votes on some major bill. They have Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin holding out on Joe Biden's infrastructure plan and forcing a scale-back version that may, in fact, come to a vote now because they were holding out on this. So there's a tendency to blame everything on the filibuster when, in fact, in part, the issue here is we just have closely divided parties, and the parties themselves aren't unified. And, you know, look at your own house before you start casting aspersions on the other party. If you can't even achieve a majority in your own party on what you want to do, it's very difficult to say, well, it's all the filibuster here.
Linda, that's an important point because I think in the last few months, both Senators Manchin and Sinema have really expressed their support for the filibuster, and they fear what will happen if the filibuster is eliminated. So as Matt pointed out, you've got at least two Democrats who are really not in line with the majority of their party.
Well, that's correct. And it's also the case that the filibuster rule could probably be reimposed by the next Congress, in fact, but it probably wouldn't be if the Republicans were in the majority. This is one of these things that it's a partisan issue until you're in the minority, in which case you become very attached to the filibuster.
Let's talk to Hedy in Norwich. Hi, Hedy. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi. Yeah. So I am in favor of the filibuster if the person doing it has to stand on the Senate floor and talk for the entire time.
And so if they want to tie up the Senate in the old days, when I say the old days, in the 1950s and 60s, I think sometimes the work of the Senate was tied up for at least a week. But that you think that might be an effective way of dealing with it?
If one person is standing there the whole time, yes. One person is talking, and when they can't talk anymore, the filibuster is over.
All right, Hedy, that's an interesting idea. Matt Dickinson, back in the 50s and 60s, when some of these filibusters went on for days and days, there were cases where, for instance, Strom Thurmond of South Carolina was filibustering the Civil Rights Act of 1957. He was actually on the floor for over 24 hours. But did they have a system where it was kind of a tag team so that one senator could pass the baton, so to speak, over to another?
Yeah, there have been instances in which they set up a rotating group of speakers. You know, there's uncertainty about if we return, because this is a commonly discussed reform. Put the onus on the people who want a filibuster. And there's other variations of this. Manchin has talked about making the individuals who want to invoke cloture, instead of getting 60 votes, get the other side to get the 41 votes to basically prevent the cloture vote from passing. But to get to the caller's question, one of the things that and this gets into the weeds of parliamentary procedure, but there is a precedent in the Senate that if there's somebody on the floor speaking and they notice that there's no one else around, they can call a quorum vote. Now, say you're in the middle, it's 2 a.m. in the morning, and the quorum call is I want the presiding officer to see whether there's a majority of senators here. If there's not, and you have a certain amount of time to round these people up, the Senate adjourns, and your bill is essentially died. So, you know, the problem with this nice little tactic is you're not really putting all the onus of keeping the debate going on the person on the floor. You've got the majority party that has to stay on its toes as well. So it really imposes costs on everybody. And the question is it worth it, right? Is it worth it to return? And I don't know. I mean, I defer to Linda on this, who knows much more about Congress than I do. But it just seems to me an open question about whether returning to that traditional type of filibuster, even with a tag team, is really the way to go forward.
I think I'm favoring more carve-outs, yep, you know, with yep. sort of the, with very clearly defined criteria.
And Linda, you might want to talk about reconciliation, which in a sense is a form of a carve out, right?
Yeah, it totally is. As one of the results of that, of course, is that because reconciliation, which are bills that pass the overall budget, are not subject to a filibuster, lawmakers try to make everything a budget issue.
Right.
And which, of course, will happen to the human capital infrastructure. If the physical infrastructure bill passes, since I'm expressing ambivalence here, one of the ways I've been trying to think about this is: okay, we have bicameral legislatures in 49 of our 50 states. They all have senates, but none of their senates are
based on a fixed number. They're all proportional to population. And they don't have filibuster rules. And so to me, I think the real problem is this fundamental political compromise that was made in 1787 to get the small states and the slave states to support ratification of the Constitution, that's really the root of the problem. And we had to amend the Constitution once before to make the Senate more democratic, and that was in 1911 when we went to direct election. So I'm thinking maybe all this talk about filibusters is sort of moot, and what we really need to do is to try to do something about the imbalance that is so extreme now in the country, with small numbers of people controlling everything that happens.
And just so, Linda, so our listeners understand, because it's a phrase they're going to hear a lot if they haven't already heard a lot, and that's budget reconciliation. You'll hear Senator Sanders talking about the infrastructure bill and saying we're going to do part of it this way, but part of it through budget reconciliation. And that they are talking about that because that basically is one of the carve-outs that they only need a majority of votes in order to pass that legislation. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that was enacted when the reconciliation process was introduced in 1973. It basically was part of this legislation that changed the budget process. Before that, Congress used to vote on individual appropriations bills, and they still do, but then they have to take an overall vote on the total budget, and that they get to that bill, which is called a reconciliation bill, where they're basically voting on one bill, but it's funding appropriations for all different parts of the government and also setting what the overall revenue projections are going to be. So it was a way to make the budget process more coherent, and that was why there was a carve-out to prohibit filibusters.
And Bob, just to follow up on that, what that points to is the so-called Byrd rule, which essentially says that only budget-related items can be included under a reconciliation bill. And it has put the spotlight on the Senate parliamentarian in trying to determine, well, what is a budget-related item and what isn't. And we saw in the COVID relief bill, Democrats tried to include an increase of the minimum wage to $15, which is what Joe Biden campaigned on. And the Senate parliamentarian said that is not allowable under the Byrd rule. And that was an opportunity for the Democrats to overrule the Senate parliamentarian. And 8 Democrats defected and said, no, we're not going to go that far. And so the minimum wage was excluded. But that's another indication of, you know, this constant tension between principle and pragmatism. And in this case, for whatever reason, some Democrats decided not to take that one step and undercut the authority of the Senate parliamentarian.
We're going to go back to our callers and talk to David, who is calling from Hinesburg. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Bob, I appreciate the opportunity. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I'm wondering what your experts would think of the idea of allowing, say, 5 filibusters a biennium, which would require the minority party to pick and choose really when they choose to do it, and then it would also put them in control of when they lose that power, because it's been the minority party under Mitch McConnell who has really raised the bar on overutilization of the filibuster. And the second piece is the 40-vote idea, or 41 votes, if you require them to be on the floor to support that action the whole time, you're actually not taking them away from visiting with their constituents at home, as I think Professor Dickinson spoke earlier, but you're taking them away from the phones. And the big thing that many senators are spending hours a day doing is fundraising. So if they lose the ability to fundraise as much, and they have to debate within themselves what issues to filibuster because they can only do it 5 times a biennium, would that change the equation?
Linda, what do you think? If there was some sort of limit on the number of filibusters a party could call for?
I think that's a really interesting idea because it forces each party's caucus to decide what are the 3 you know, what are the three or five things that are going to come up this year that we want to make sure we can exercise the prerogatives of the minority? And you'd have to say, since filibusters are individuals, you don't want to give every senator five filibusters. So you'd have to figure out how you were going to count the number of filibusters. But I think that's quite an intriguing idea because it forces people to actually go with the intent of the filibuster, which is to decide, is there such strong sentiment against a particular measure that we're willing to use one of our precious filibusters to stop it?
Let's see if we can get a quick call in from Scott in Brattleboro. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great.
I've been listening to the program, and I wonder, you know, if our government doesn't just negate itself, and, you know, that the bouncing ball back and forth never gets anything done. I wonder if it's a threat to our planet and our future and, you know, our politics. And I really wonder at this point if they should even have professional politicians, if it shouldn't be some other sort of arrangement, or just have everyone in the country vote on everything. Because even though it seems like it would take a long time, it seems like it would be a lot quicker than for these people. You know, there's some sort of a quote that says something about talking while Rome burns or something like that. And that's how it makes me feel, you know, like, oh, great, they're having a good time debating how they don't get anything done, you know, and why. And that's the most ridiculous conversation that I can imagine. They should just be getting things done.
Scott, I think there are a number of people who share your frustration. Matt Dickinson, as we look around the world and we see a lot of parliamentary forms of government, is there an equivalent in the parliamentary form of government of a filibuster, or does that not really exist?
Well, it's called a no-confidence vote. I mean, one of the things that these parliamentary systems have is the ability to, because the executive is usually fused with the legislative assembly, you have a government that is more accountable in the sense that they can pass what they want. But if they can't, it immediately goes to the voters in many instances, and the voters are asked to, in a sense, pass judgment on the gridlock, on whether you want to continue with the gridlock or reconvene with a new political coalition. The United States does not have that. We have, you know, separated institutions. And Linda and I had a very interesting exchange that she hosted earlier this year, in which we discussed this broader question that your last speaker brought up, which is, you know, are we more worried about what government can do to us, which was the framers' concern in protecting individual liberties, or have things changed so dramatically in two centuries that we should be more concerned about what the government can't do and should be doing in terms of addressing problems? And, you know, there's no clear-cut answer to this, and too often the answer comes down to, well, it's whether I support this particular policy or not. That's the type of government that I want. But it is an enduring question, and it is a reminder that the American political system is exceptional. It is designed with a different purpose in mind than most other governments. Not to say that that exceptionalism is better, but it is different.
And Matt, would it be fair to say, as you look at the parliamentary form of government in other countries, that within a party there's probably less variation of points of view, whereas in the United States you could have a very liberal Democrat and a very conservative Democrat?
Well, traditionally I would say yes. One of the difficulties that we're experiencing is we are adopting parliamentary-type parties, liberal Democrats and conservative Republicans, but our institutional system is still the same one of shared powers. In our parliamentary systems, yeah, you have more homogenous parties, but you often have more of them, which requires coalition building across these party lines. We, in many respects, and I think Linda's alluded to this, we're in the worst of two possible worlds here, a parliamentary-type party system superimposed on a non-parliamentary institutional structure.
It's a fascinating issue, something we're going to be following very closely in the weeks ahead. as the Democrats decide how they're going to deal with this issue over the summer and the fall. And we'll certainly be reporting on that as it happens. Many thanks to our guest today for helping us better understand a really key element of our governmental process. Linda Fowler, thank you very much. And Matt Dickinson, thank you as well. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Bye now.